the opinions you love, the history you crave. This is Rant EM Radio.
The recognized symbol of excellence in sports entertainment.
The Shining Wizards Network proudly presents the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast with your hosts, the Impact Playa, Phil Rea, and Dave Mega Powers.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, your new recognized symbol of excellence in sports entertainment broadcasting from the current to the way back. We are the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. As always, your gracious host, the Impact Player, Mr. Phil Ray, and I am joined in studio by...
You know, it's pimps up and hose down, time for some champagne spills and Cadillac thrills with the Mega Powers.
Goddamn right, we're pimping hose nationwide this evening.
24/7.
Live on rantemradio.com. We are a Shining Wizards Network production. Hello to everybody in the chat room. I saw Scott, the first one in.
Scott!
That's right. Good evening to you.
Got Sugar Shane.
Sugar Shane's in there. We got Rex.
T-Rex.
T-Rex. Rex Watson is in there. That's the with the Jurassic Park fucking logo. That's delicious, actually. All right. So, we got a nice little episode for you tonight.
Yeah, we got a guest. It's been a while.
Well, we were going to have two guests, but at a little before 6 p.m. tonight, Dick Bourne, the author of the upcoming book, Big Gold Belt, canceled on us. He couldn't come on last minute. The book comes out in 2 weeks.
But he's coming back on, right?
He's coming back on. He's already confirmed. He just, you know, he apologized. Go to thebiggoldbelt.com. If you don't know what the Big Gold Belt is, you shouldn't be listening to this podcast.
Or maybe you should be listening
to
this podcast.
Well, you have to be educated, but everybody knows the Big Gold Belt. It's the World Heavyweight Championship now in WWE. But from 86 to 2000, it was represented by the NWA, WCW, and then, of course, the WCW International title, which was held, I believe, by Rick Rude, right?
Ravishing,
right.
Rick Rude.
Right.
Hey, didn't that great wrestler David Arquette win that belt too?
For like, yeah. Oh, please, please don't get me started. But the good people at Crowbar Press hooked us up with Mr. Kit Bauman. He's coming on tonight to talk about the Luthez autobiography entitled Hooker. That's going to be in about an hour. We have a lot of stuff going on in the next couple of weeks, so I really hope you guys stay tuned. And Dave and I are working diligently to give you guys the best, the very best in fucking throwback wrestling.
And we actually got a guest for next week, too.
Yes, old school WWF photographer.
Tom Buchanan.
Mr. Tom Buchanan's coming on.
And he's going to be telling some stories.
Yeah, Tom's got some crazy stories, apparently. Dave hooked up with him a couple of months ago. We just couldn't get on board with when he was coming on.
Yeah.
So
he's just one of those kind of guys. He doesn't keep in touch with what's going on now, but he's just one of those guys who's a really humble dude. He's been with WWF since I believe the time span for him was 87 to either 97 or 2000, somewhere around there. He was up there until WrestleMania 17, and you know, guy's really open. He's got so many stories to tell that nobody's ever heard. So we're going to have an awesome, awesome show with him next week.
Right. So Tom Buchanan next week, Kip Bowman this week. We're going to work on Dick Bourne, and by that time we should have our anniversary, which is 2 years coming up, first week of July. And we got a kick-ass throwback for that Dave and I have been diligently trying to work on.
Yeah.
And we're probably going to have some guests in studio. Hope maybe we can have the some of the Wizards, maybe the Midnight Jury guys can come up from Philly and Jersey, respectively. So hopefully that'll work. I'd like to have some of the network guys on. Maybe some of the Rant guys will join us. It'd be a fun time.
We had all-star occasion.
We had a good time last year. We did some War Games stuff last year for the one-year anniversary.
We had Shining Wizards Matt.
Yep, Shining Wizards Matt stopped by. And hopefully, yeah, I want to get Kevin on the show, man. Kevin is the only wizard not to come on the show with us.
We can arrange that.
Yeah, I think Mr. Garifo needs to make an appearance. But a lot of stuff going on in the world of professional wrestling. Before we get into our Facebook questions, just a couple of news and notes. Dave and I were talking before doing some pre-production stuff. As you all know, there was a bunch of cuts the last couple of days in the WWE. Brodus Clay was cut. Kurt Hawkins was cut. Yoshitatsu was cut. One of the Divas were cut that nobody cares about.
Oksana
was, yeah.
She wasn't doing anything.
No, she wasn't doing anything.
Even Jericho said on his show, was like, she ain't doing nothing. So
I didn't listen to the Jericho show, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
He put her down.
Brodus Clay is already confirmed for PWS on September 20th with Kurt Hawkins. Kurt Hawkins does the wrestling school anyway with Pat Buck. Creator Pro, I think it's called.
I'm not sure.
I don't want to fuck it up, but I know
that's
they have
a Shining Wizards deal, right?
Yeah,
there.
they have a wrestling school.
Boys.
Yeah, they have a wrestling school. Hawkins was on the Wizards last night. He called in. Those guys are already fucking booked, so good for them.
It's good that they're doing something afterwards. You know, I actually enjoyed what Brodus Clay was doing as the heel on NXT. Of course, he jobbed out to Adrian Neville, and
I don't know much. Anyway, good.
But I love doing that.
I know.
Anyway.
I'm gonna make a sound bit for it.
There needs to be somebody. I think we need to get Matt to do like a photo of Adrian Neville with the big ass mole.
Yeah, that's what we should do. Yeah, Matt,
and wearing like some sort of like cut off like denim vest.
Yeah, Matt's our Photoshop guy.
Yeah, maybe we could make that a T-shirt or something.
British Columbia Matt. We'll call him BC Matt.
Yeah, but I really love the stuff that they're doing on NXT, and again, like the way that they work the show is so old school, and they're like doing shit with the nobody guys.
I dig NXT. I like the fact that, like you said, it's got that small arena gymnasium indie feel to it. I like the fact that their guys are talented. There's not really a bad bunch of people there.
Yeah,
you know. I got to tell you, though, getting back to Brodus Clay for a second, I want to backtrack. Uh-huh. Our buddy Ben Roberts from RingWars.com from the UK was chiming in the other day about Brodus Clay, and he made a good point, and I agreed with him. Brodus Clay would be fucking awesome in Japan.
Oh, yeah. I never even thought about that, but that would be a great idea.
I mean, listen, the evolution of the big man has come to full fruition. Every big man that's in the business now, in the last, I'd say, even 10 or 15 years, can legit move and very agile.
Yeah.
And I thought Brodus Clay, to his credit, could move for a big man,
Yeah.
He would be a fantastic fit in New Japan.
I think in any Japanese promotion, because if anything, if Japan's proved over the years, time and time again, is like if, guys can't get their thing together in America, usually Japan has something for them. And typically, they find their audience over there.
All right, so the chat room is chiming in already with the cuts that happened. Do you think it's making room to bring up some of the NXT peeps? I don't know about that, Scotty, because now Vince is talking about cutting back. They're cutting back on travel. They're making people drive to different cities now and not
flying.
They're cutting back on intros and production-wise and stuff like that. They want to cut $20 million off the budget.
Yeah.
Apparently, he's already going to Japan.
Okay.
Tenzai was there. Listen, if Tenzai can get him a hook and he's in there, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah. And since we're going into NXT a little bit, Vince is starting to shit on some of the NXT guys, which it makes sense because they already brought in a bunch of people like Paige and Bo Dallas and Adam Rose, and all of them are not really getting the reactions that they were expecting, and it just makes me think all the NXT shows are all in Florida. They're all drawing the same crowd. So, they don't really have, a chance to really find out what, other people are thinking about them. So I think it would be, I know they used to do NXT, as, what was it, before SmackDown or before Raw. They would tape them shows there. I don't know, maybe it would be a good idea to start bringing those guys, do the show in Florida, but at the same time, have, these guys out on the road, doing stuff before Raw, SmackDown, gauge the audience's interest.
Do main event stuff and dark matches and stuff like that you're talking about? Because they do main event. Don't they film the main event match before Raw?
I don't know when they film them.
Yeah, I think that's the way it is. I think that's how it goes. They do that dark match and they play it on the main event.
Yeah, because, if they're, how could I word it? Bo Dallas and Adam Rose, these guys were primarily in NXT just doing the matches over in Florida. And they're getting over there, but, that's not really going to guarantee that, we'll say a crowd in Virginia or Kentucky or something like that's going to, be over with those guys too,
It just makes me wonder why. Listen, Vince is almost 70 years old, okay? And I understand his stance on the cutbacks. I know the stock dropped a little bit because of it.
Yeah.
That's going to happen regardless. Like, anytime a big company does something drastic like that, the stock drops because people panic. So, I think Vince should start stepping away. I'm listening to Paul Heyman on Austin's podcast a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And, Paul said all Vince does is work.
Yeah.
Like, to this day, he goes home for like a day a week and that's it. He works constantly.
And he wants to work on his days
off. That's what he wants to do. And you know what? You're almost 70 years old. The wheels are turning now and the time to change in. And I think you should let Stephanie and Triple H do the real deal behind the scenes shit. I mean, listen, Triple H gets a lot of shit for putting himself over, but I got to be honest with you. I mean, he did fuck up the tag team division a little bit, but the NXT stuff is good.
Oh, tag team division's been fucked up for
right,
years.
And he tried for a little bit, but not so much. And then again, I think Vince needs to step back a little bit now and let these guys run it. And Snowy White is in the chat room from Winnipeg. How are you?
Oh, a long time listener, first time chatter.
Snowy White, Winnipeg, Manitoba, go Jets, big hockey fan. So,
and yes, you are doing this right.
The Jet, Winnipeg is a hockey hotbed right now for the last couple of seasons. They brought the Jets back from the dead. But anyway. So anyway, I don't think it's such a bad thing to cut people's intros and cut back on production and stuff.
I think it's kind of horrible that they're cutting back on having the crew, giving the crew their bus to get to the shows. Because essentially, I'm sure after these guys are, done with what they're doing, literally like setting up and closing shop, I think the last thing that they want to do is drive to the hotel or drive to the next, location. They want to just get on the bus and do their thing.
I got
to
be honest with you. Back in the day, that's all they fucking did. They got in these big trucks and they drove with talent. They drove with people. I mean, I'm not opposed to that. I'm not. I'm sorry. That's what they did back in the day. I'm an old school guy.
Yeah, but they didn't have the setup that they have now.
But you're not taking the equipment with you. They have truck drivers for that. It ain't like you're fucking hey Bob, the cable guy. The camera cable guy. Can you do me a favor? Can you put 300 feet of cable in the back of your rental car? They're not doing that. So they can travel to in packs. They can save money, fuel, and all other shit, and let the fucking trucks just go cross-country like they've been doing. You know? You don't have to fly these fucking camera guys all over the country. Unless you're going... Listen. Unless you're going overseas.
Yeah.
Okay? That's fine. You have to, obviously.
Typically, for a lot of, like, film production, they do fly a lot of those guys around.
Yeah. So,
and it makes a big difference. You know, these guys work hard.
They do.
They're not working a 9-to-5. They're working like a 12-hour, maybe even a 12-hour plus day. They have to make sure everything's set up and working fine, so we don't have any more Owen Harts or anything like that, or Road Warrior Hawks.
Yeah, but you know what? The only time they're working hard is when they're doing SmackDown and Raw.
Yeah.
They're not, for the house shows, they're not doing all the elaborate shit.
Yeah,
they're just setting the sound up and the pyro. It's you know. It's not as hard as I think as you think it is.
I don't know. You know, I'm not in their shoes. But
no, we're
going
to agree to disagree. I just, again, I've seen guys that have done like concerts and stuff like that. It's almost the same kind of deal. I know guys in the business who do like rock concerts and shit, and it's the same setup except our stage show as a wrestling fan is a little more elaborate than some of the stage shows these concerts have. You know, it's not, it's one fucking spot. It's not a whole big thing.
Yeah,
but.
Oh, we'll
agree to disagree.
Yeah.
All right. Any other? We'll see what other news here.
The TNA six-sided ring debacle.
You know what? You guys all know this. I'm a gimmick guy. I loved the six-sided ring.
Yeah.
I get shit for it. I know a lot of guys get a lot of our peers give me a lot of shit for it, but people are like, oh, you have to learn to wrestle again if you're in a six-sided ring. What are you, a luchador? First of all, if you have to learn the two extra fucking pads in the ring.
Yeah.
Unless you're an X Division guy or a luchador, it's going to fuck you up a little bit. But for the stationary guys, it's not going to make a difference.
No.
Okay?
You know, and I agree with you. And I know Shining Wizards said he posted that question out to, his listeners and all that. And, you know, he specifically asked for the wrestlers, you know, their feedback. And, there was a few of them that were like, oh, you know, it sucks. And Sugar Shane Helms, you know, he was like, you know, took me 20 seconds to figure it out. And that's that. And, you know, just in my opinion, you know, I'd place my vote for the six-sided ring. But at the end of the day, if it's going to set them apart from WWE, give them a little bit, you know, something to differentiate themselves. Regardless of the ring is stiff or not, or regardless of what the workers think, at the end of the day, we're paying to see guys beat the shit out of each other. They're going to get hurt regardless. It's the profession that they chose. And if you're working as a wrestler or you're working a 9-to-5, if the boss says, hey, this is what we're going to do, you want to be on the same page so your shit looks tight. And you're not making a fool out of yourself and not making a fool out of the company that you're a part of because, you know, one supports the other. And, if the fans decide to bring back the six-sided ring, which they're going to bring, you know, the decision's going to be, made as soon as next week.
Right.
For the New York shows. That's where whatever the decision is, it's going to be at the New York shows. If it's a six-sided ring, you just got to roll with it, whether you're a veteran or not. You know, if that's the direction that the company's going and you're choosing to be with that company, you know, that's your choice and you got to honor your choice and just roll with it. If you don't like it, voice your opinions and, you know, have some sort of alternative.
For the last almost 20 years, I've worked in an industry where I have to follow state and city protocol. And now with communications, I do a national protocol. And some of the stuff doesn't make sense, you know. Even common sense wise, and a lot of protocol in any kind of company is based on surveys.
Yeah, making
like,
people happy.
I'll give you a good example. I'm a certified CPR instructor with the American Heart Association. 97% of their fucking protocol is all survey. These guys were never first responders. They were never doctors. They were never teachers, anything. They've never done CPR in their entire life.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think, at the end of the day, if I'm the boss of the company and I say, listen, I'm putting a six-sided ring in, it's a gimmick thing, work with it. I mean, it doesn't take that long. No. And the people and the wrestlers who are responding online about it, half of them aren't on TV. I guarantee you, if I said, "Hey, hey, Sugar Shane Helms, if you didn't like it, what if I put you on TNA tomorrow?" You know, he would fucking, if he didn't like the ring. I'm saying,
yeah, yeah.
Well, any of these guys, if they didn't like the ring, if I told you you're gonna be on TV tomorrow, you'd go crazy.
Yeah, I think there was only like one other guy who responded to memory who actually did work the six-sided ring and didn't like it. But at the end of the day, it's your job, and if you're choosing to work for that company, figure it out. You know, it's, you know, I know it's a burden for a lot of people, you know, whether it's, you know, some sort of weird CPR rule that you have to start following that doesn't make any sense, or wrestling in a ring that doesn't make any sense.
Right. It's at the end of the day, if it's what they want you to do, you do it.
Yeah. At the end of the day, a lot of guys, they want to be the best, you know, whether they're actually, you know, given that or not, you know, they want to get noticed. They want to do all that. Austin Aries went apeshit about it, a little apeshit, according to Sugar Shane.
So what?
But
then leave. Then go back to Ring of Honor.
Yeah.
Or go to PWS, or go to one of these other, go to Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, go to New Japan, go to somewhere. Yeah. If you don't like what you're doing, then go.
Yeah.
You know, it's the thing. Speaking of, is that our boy?
Yeah.
There he is. So, anyway, speaking of TNA, apparently the Hardy Boys are reuniting for the New York shows. They're pulling out all the stops because they wanted that fucking TV contract.
I thought Jeff Hardy. I thought he wasn't allowed out of the state or something like that. Or am I thinking something completely wrong?
I think
wrong?
He's not allowed out of the country.
Oh, okay.
Because he's a criminal and a junkie. Well, he was.
Shake the crime stick.
Right. But the Hardy Boys are reuniting, apparently. And that's pretty – I mean, that's cool. I like the Hardy Boys. I never disliked them. To see them on TV again is cool. I just wish, and for that tag team division, they have the Wolves, they have the Bromans, they have a couple of good tag teams.
I got the Von Erichs
now. Oh, how I didn't see Slammiversary, but I heard the Von Erichs kicked ass. I downloaded it. I'm probably gonna watch it tonight after the show.
I still gotta watch the stuff that you gave me. I have so little time to watch.
Yeah, dude, being a grown up sucks, man. Huh. Being a grown up, I hate being a grown up doing all this shit.
Well, at the same time, I don't like sitting at home just watching wrestling all day. But
I can't much as I want to. I can't.
I will say this: when I do get the time to watch wrestling, it feels so good.
It's the greatest feeling in the world. One of the greatest.
Oh, I know somebody mentioned Hogan. You know, doesn't like the six-sided ring.
Well, him and Bischoff put the kibosh on it, right?
And I'm pretty sure it's because he's, you know, he might have like those Vietnam like flashbacks to his big match with
Zeus.
You know, if I was almost murdered in the ring by Zeus, I wouldn't want to, you know, step into. I think that was actually an eight-sided ring, but still, you know, the memory remains.
Hogan's got.
Came out of jail.
I know, but
match.
Hogan's got some success in the cage. He shouldn't have won with Orndorff, but that's besides the point. But
yeah.
We already talked about that months ago, but Hogan's got some success in the steel cage. Yeah. I don't know why they put the fucking...
But he never wrestled in a cage. Well, he did wrestle in a cage with a murderer, Zeus.
Zeus.
You know, actually dished out the $10 to get the Blu-ray.
Did you?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies.
I told you what happened. I bought the fucking DVD last year.
So did I.
And it wasn't on Blu-ray.
No. And now a year later it came out, which didn't make any sense.
Did you play the Blu-ray yet?
No, not yet.
All right, does the Blu-ray have the match?
Yeah, it has both the Zeus matches. It has a SummerSlam match and has the No Holds Barred Cage match.
Right, that came out when you ordered the movie on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
Not what they call it. They didn't call it pay-per-view back then. They called it, the fuck did they call it? On demand, maybe?
No, whatever. No, that's now. That's now.
No, what the hell was it called?
I don't know. They call it paying for something.
I don't know what the fuck it was called, but yeah, it was like, that was the big thing. You got the movie and the match afterwards.
Yeah. I think it had, like, demand in the name or something like that, or viewer's choice or some bullshit like that.
Yeah, viewer's choice, that's it. Yes. Okay, thank you, Dave.
But, yeah, I dished out for the Blu-ray. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
We're doing the Throwbacks Theater, by the way.
Which I work in film, and I'm sure a lot of people would start crying if they heard about that.
You have to get us situated with that. I want to be able to watch the movie and, you know, do a Mystery Science Theater thing.
Yeah. We'll make sure to do that. It's gonna happen.
Oh God,
we've been wanting to do that since the show started. So
you are not lying.
Yeah,
you are not lying. All right. Let's see what else we got going on here.
The Ring of Honor.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I'm not missing any fucking news here.
Knockouts bikini calendar. Oh,
Jesus. Nobody cares about that.
I don't even know who the knockouts are on Impact or TNA or whatever they're calling themselves now.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. All right, Ring of Honor finally getting pay-per-view.
Live.
I'm actually going to get it, I think.
What's the card? What's the rundown?
All right, Best in the World pay-per-view is coming this coming Sunday,
yeah.
June 22nd. Let's see. It's official. The Fallen Angel, Christopher Daniels, and Mr. Kazarian, or better, otherwise known as Bad Influence, making their Ring of Honor debut.
Should be letting Mikey watch that then.
Nah.
Well, they're
going to challenge whoever the World Tag Team Champions are. Right now, I think it's Bobby Fish and Kyle O'Reilly.
Yeah, Red Dragon.
Red Dragon. Bobby Fish was on the Wizards last night. The Briscoes are taking on Matt Hardy and Michael Bennett in a grudge match.
Oh.
Let's see. I know Adam Cole was fighting Michael Elgin. Where is the fucking lineup for this thing? How come I don't see it here? I'm trying to get all the fucking...
apologize, folks.
Yeah, no, it is what it is. I'm trying to... It's in Nashville. They don't give you a fucking rundown and shit. Go up there. Let's see. Click here for more info. Oh, no, the live one?
Yeah.
Okay. Upcoming events.
Yeah, there's got to be a...
Okay.
Apologize, folks.
There you go. Who cares? We're fucking live here.
Maybe somebody does care.
All right, listen. Yeah, it's blank.
Oh, there it is.
There we go.
Yeah, I told you.
Okay, Elgin's fighting Cold. Bad Influence is fighting Red Dragon. That's going to be a phenomenal match.
Yeah.
Matt Taven going for the TV championship with Jay Lethal. I like Jay Lethal as a heel. And we all love Truth Martini anyway.
I need
anyway.
To see more of the show to really judge Jay Lethal as a heel.
Hardy and Bennett versus the Briscoes, like I mentioned. Mr. Wrestling, Kevin Steen versus the Last Real Man, Silas Young. Apparently this is Steen's last match in Ring of Honor. He's supposed to be going to WWE.
It's official. He'll be in WWE.
Right. Submission match. Roderick Strong versus Cedric Alexander. And this was just added, I think, today or yesterday. The six-man mayhem match. Winner gets a future TV title shot.
In the future.
Right. ACH taking on Watanabe.
Yep.
Versus Caprice.
Watanabe.
Right. Versus Caprice Coleman. Versus Thaddeus Thomas. Versus BJ Whitmer. Versus Tommaso Ciampa. Of course, Kevin Kelly, Steve Corino, and Nigel McGuinness will be on commentary. And they're taping two extra matches before the pay-per-view featuring War Machine, Raymond Rowe, and Hansen.
Oh.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah,
all right,
the Tennessee State Fairgrounds.
Right.
Isn't that like where TNA used to do their asylum shows or something like that?
Well, no, they did it indoors, the asylum.
Yeah.
Maybe. Is the fairgrounds outdoors?
I don't know.
Never been. All right,
haven't really been hanging around Tennessee, too.
Either way, man, it's going to be available June 22nd on pay-per-view, and it should be a great card. I think Elgin might finally take the fucking belt, man. They've been jacking him up the last couple of months.
Yeah, and the dude is so good.
Yeah, Michael Elgin puts on a really good show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a short dude, but God, when you see this guy manhandle these people, it's insane.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, Cole's coming off a big victory against Liger, beat him with the figure four of all moves. Oh, not that the figure four is like this horrible move or anything, but it was just completely unexpected. So
that's pretty much it. Then next week, of course, is the Money in the Bank stuff.
Yeah,
we'll preview that next show. We'll do our predictions and we'll run down the card. Let's do some Facebook questions. Not many this week. You guys are slacking.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll pull some from the chat room. We got about maybe 25, 30 minutes before Mr. Kip Bowman calls in. So
we can take some calls or something.
We could probably take some calls before that, too. All right. Let's see here. All right. Mark, our buddy Mark, wants to know, with the World Cup season in full effect, I'll ask an international question. Who, in your opinion, was the best non-North American wrestler to succeed in America? For me personally, it's Regal and Haku. Wow. Wow, the best non-North American wrestler. Man.
I was thinking about this one, too, earlier.
Well, I mean, you want to go up north right away. You got
Bret Hart.
Bret Hart. You got Edge. You yeah. have Christian.
Chris Benoit.
Chris Benoit. I mean, there's a bunch of Canadian guys. Lance Storm were fantastic workers.
Mil Mascaras.
Well, yeah, Mexico. Now, Japan, you got Chono, Muda, Kensuke Sasaki.
Yeah, well, Muda, definitely.
Muda, probably the best Japanese.
Conan.
Conan in Mexico. Conan's not even fucking Mexican, dude. I think he's like Cuban and Jewish or something like that.
But he was born in Mexico.
Right, he was born in Mexico.
I would say Rey Mysterio, but he was actually born in, what, like California?
Yeah, San Diego.
Yeah, so he doesn't count.
He doesn't count.
No.
Regal, of course, in England, but England is Dynamite Kid.
Yeah, Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Bulldog. British Bulldog.
Wearing a British Bulldog shirt.
He's got a British Bulldog shirt on right now.
$7 on WWEshop.com.
Man, the guy here with these wise buys, getting all these deals.
I know, dude. It's what happens when you're on a budget.
Yeah. Take what you can get.
There's a bunch of guys, dude. I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, there's so many. I mean, of course.
Even Luthez. I believe he was born in Germany, right, outside of the U.S.
And then, you have the Samoan lineage.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, Mark. I wouldn't be able to. I can't wrap my head around one definitive guy because there's so many guys in each region of the world, you know?
Yeah. I think probably right now, probably the biggest one is probably Bret Hart.
Bret Hart, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Sugar Shane wants to know, in your opinion, guys, what is the most underrated match of all time, specifically WWF? He really does appreciate the podcast and wishes there was a donation. Oh, dude, don't worry about donating anything. Just put more shirts out, buy more shirts.
Oh, you can give me some money.
What's wrong with you?
What? I got the LASIK bills to pay this.
Yeah. Thoughts and prayers to Mega Powers. He's having fucking LASIK surgery this weekend.
Yeah. Hopefully I won't have to have a blindfold match with Rick Martel.
I asked Dave if he wanted to ride home. He said he already had one. Yeah. I was going to get him one of them fucking the cataract glasses.
I think they might be giving me something like that.
You got to get a picture of that.
Because I'm going to be on Valium from what I've been told.
Yeah, you're going to fuck your eyes up for a little while. I mean, you're getting like precise lasers zapped in your fucking corneas.
I'm going to have better than 20/20 vision.
Yeah, you're blowing up over here on your cell phone.
Just fellow network buddy, Mr. Anthony Quadro.
How is Anthony?
He's a fucking maniac. That's how he listens
to the show, right?
No,
he doesn't
listen to anything. He's a strange guy. He's never been on any of the shows. He's just mentioned a lot. I think last time I saw him, we went out for dinner, and he was just completely normal, which everybody was just kind of like, what?
All right, so let's answer Shane's question.
Yeah.
The most underrated match, I mean, there's...
Specifically WWF, of
specifically
course.
Specifically WWF. I can go back as far as the Boston Garden match with Savage and the Warrior. Because everybody talks about Savage Warrior Mania, which is that's your favorite match.
The title for title match.
Title for title at the Boston Garden.
Yeah.
But your favorite match was the WrestleMania one.
Yeah.
Okay.
WrestleMania 7.
I thought that the Boston Garden match was better. Let's see. There was a bunch of WWF house shows. Listen.
British Bulldogs against Hart Foundation.
Yeah.
Anytime that they faced each other.
Honestly, one of the most underrated matches I've ever saw was when Flair first came over, his first Garden match with Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really good match, and I was there. And
had the false three count
at
the end.
Yeah, that was an underrated match. There's so many, dude. There's so many.
One that immediately popped to mind was Boston Garden again. It was Steamboat against Bret Hart. While Bret Hart was heel in the Hart Foundation.
Wrestling Classic in 1985, Dynamite Kid versus Ricky Steamboat in the tournament.
No. He went against David Boy Smith. In the tournament.
I'm sorry, you're right. Davey Boy against Ricky Steamboat.
Dynamite against Macho Man.
Match. Yeah, but the Ricky Steamboat Davey Boy Smith match was very underrated.
Yeah.
And I think Davey Boy got injured, if I'm not mistaken. It was like a friendly thing. And faces them before faces like that back then on a national scale.
Davey Boy Smith had a wicked nut shot.
That's right.
Which, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat being the humble face that he is, made sure to take care of his nuts.
Right, exactly. Harry wants to know, what was your favorite pay-per-view stage entrance? area. Beach Blast is always my favorite. WrestleMania 17 was just so iconic. Wow.
I'm thinking for me, NWO, the first NWO sold out.
Sold out.
Which also brings harkens to mind the Starrcade 89. Mm. Future Shock. That was pretty much the same entrance. But I thought those were pretty cool because it looked like a fucking, you know, the rock band Queen, like their setup back in the, I think like early 80s. Looked like something like that. Looked like they're fucking coming off the mothership or something.
Right. For me, I have a few. The Royal Rumble from the Garden a few years ago with the subway-looking thing they had when John Cena made his return. That was great. Of course, WrestleMania 17 was awesome. I dug NWO Sold Out. I love that.
Halloween Havocs.
Halloween Havocs, yeah. The first
tombstones.
The first two or three were great with the tombstones and all that nonsense. And then they had, I think it was the Great American Bash outdoors when Flair fought, I want to say Nikita Koloff when he came in the helicopter. I think it was in like the Orange Bowl Stadium. I think it was one of the stadiums down south. I'm not sure, but Flair came in on a helicopter with the fucking. That was
it. Was one of the I think it was one of the Great American Bashes.
Yeah, that was pretty dope.
He went against Ricky Morton in a cage.
No. This is him. We fought Nikita Koloff specifically. It was on one of those. It was the tour. It wasn't like one of the main matches. He fought Ricky Morton also.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did
the helicopter thing twice. Then
yeah.
All right. I'll go with that.
Yeah.
Lopez. What's up, handsome Dan Lopez?
It's been quiet these days.
Yeah. Do you guys think wrestling could go back to what it was in Thez's day? Would today's fan appreciate it? I'm going to say no, although I would appreciate it. I'm sure Dave would appreciate it. A lot of our fans would appreciate it, but for the masses, no, because it wasn't really as entertaining as it is now.
Well, this is the way that I see it. It's, you know, the sport has developed significantly. But also, keep in mind, you know, the guy's career spanned from the 30s into the 90s. So the guy was a world champion at age 21. So he went through so many, you know, different changes in wrestling style. You know, he was raised on being a legit wrestler. You know, the name of his book is called Hooker, which is another which is another way of saying a shooter,
grappler. Yeah.
And you know, champions at that time, like specifically the world champion, had to be a guy who can hold his own. They weren't going to let a performer, you know, in the style of I don't know, like the guys that we have now, like. Trying to like a Duke the Dumpster Drozzy. If he was a big guy, a hot shot back then, there was no way that he was going to hold the world title. Because when you pick up the book Hooker, which is a phenomenal read, if you want to hear how the business has changed over all these decades, and how fucking corrupt these organizations were, you'll see, like, a lot of these, specifically, another reason why they would have guys like Thez who could hold their own was because this was like a, you know, say a promoter over in, I don't know, fucking bumblefuck Mississippi or something like that was trying to get the edge over on one of their guys. They would send in a guy like Thez so none of that shit would happen. And in the main event, like, it's pretty much like, hey, you want me to break your fucking arm during the match, or are you going to play right? And it's like, okay.
And, so, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
So, yeah, you know, there was a lot of the top guys, they could wrestle for a reason. And, you know, also keep in mind, you know, he was mentored by guys like Ed Strangler Lewis.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a dude who, during his time, which wasn't too far away from Thez's, would have, like, four-hour matches.
And they innovated some moves.
Yeah.
STF, the press, the
power bomb.
The power bomb. So, I mean, it's
the belly-to-back suplex. German
suplex. Yeah. So, you know, I think fans would appreciate it, but I don't know if it would be, I guess, marketable, like, Like
it's called MMA, folks.
Right.
If you want to see wrestling, real wrestling, it's called
MMA. It's mixed martial arts, which is pretty much what it has evolved to now.
Yeah.
What Fez was doing back in the day. He would stretch people out legit and, you know, get away with it because, you know, he did it better than everybody else.
Yeah. And there's so many stories in this book. It's, you know, once Kit comes on, you know, before we did the interview with Emerson Murray for the Bruiser Brody book, the first book I got from Crowbar Press was the Hooker book, was because I wanted to read this book for years. It was kind of like this kind of like lost book because, you know, once we get Kit on, he'll explain. Like, it was, they were, you know, putting together this book, but, you know, since the generation gap, they really couldn't get this book published. So they had to try to shop it to so many different people. You know, it literally came down to, like, there's a lot of old school wrestling fans who wanted to hear this story, and it came down to literally Lou Thesz and his wife Xeroxing every page of the book that they had printed and, you know, having it bound at a Kinko's and selling it on AOL back when that started.
Right.
Surprisingly enough, Lou Thesz was internet literate back in the early to mid-90s. And, you know, the book was just kind of passed around, and there were so many different versions of the book because there would be all these edits because he's a wrestler and he remembers things a certain way that historians don't remember. So, you know, so many different versions of the book. So for me to find out, like, that there was finally, like, a set edition of this book, because, you know, Thesz is dead now. He can't rewrite the book. There ain't going to be any more editions of this unless, some dramatic discoveries are found and more people buy the book. But it just really, like, captured my imagination. And some of the stories in here are wild, stuff that, you know, you ain't going to be hearing nowadays with, you know, guys being locked up in their hotel rooms playing Xbox or whatever. And, you know, I really wanted to, you know, do this book first, but I wanted to appease the fans of Duke Bruiser Brody because that was a hell of a book, too, and we had a hell of an interview there. So we're going to get Kit on the line around, like, 10 o'clock for our, you know, our typical throwback time.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk shop because this is a really awesome book. And actually, Brody was one of the dudes that Thesz trained, believe it or not. So, Lou Thesz's influence, you know, has, you know, spanned even to, you know, the hardcore style. And, you know, we talked about it on the Bruiser Brody, Emerson Murray interview that, Brody could go. He was versatile. He wasn't just one way, but, you know, for what he was known for, he had that reckless, renegade style to his wrestling. But overall, I think I thought it was funny too. Was it months ago? This had to be like several months ago, sometime like I think maybe like late last year on the now public Studplexes group, which I don't really I got to post some more videos on there, but I don't really have that much time. It's we talked about this on the other show. We got full-time jobs. We're trying to make time to watch some wrestling and talk about it.
You see what I have going on here. You know, I have a family and...
You don't even have time to pick up your kid.
Right. I was so fucking... I mean, I had to pick up the kid from school today. I was like, oh, this is crazy.
Yeah.
You know,
but let me get back on track. But several months ago, I posted Pat O'Connor going against Nature Boy Buddy Rogers.
Right.
Over at Kaninsky Park. And was it Shiny Wizards Tony and... Buddy Lopez were losing their shit over this match, and I was kind of like, huh. I thought it was interesting that, you know, for Studplexes, I just throw whatever the hell I'm watching, you know, whether it's Coco Beware doing some dumb bullshit or Hulk Hogan in the Dungeon of Doom or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, I wanted to watch some, like, really old school shit, and, you know, I threw up that match with Buddy Rogers against Pat O'Connor, who was another legit wrestler, a hooker. And got a good response. And even when we were over at Legends of the Ring, and Tony and I were talking with the Fink, Tony was bringing that match up to the Fink too. And there's still an appeal for that style of wrestling. But I don't know. I think it would have to be contested, maybe, you know, maybe Japan or something like that, or just straight up mixed martial arts. That's what it comes down to.
I'll tell you what, and I've mentioned this a few times on the show. I think fans need to appreciate what, you know, our predecessors, only because of how the sport evolved. And what Dave mentioned before about Luthez is, you know, Kip chronologically put this book together solely on Thez's, you know, like he would kept going back to stuff and bringing stuff up, and yeah, you know, because again, territories rule the day, and you know, you talk about 40 years of wrestling, 50 years of wrestling. I mean, the guy, his last fucking match was in 1990.
Against Chono. Oh, yeah, Masahiro Chono in New Japan.
You know, and he was 71 years old. So, you know, this is... when Dave talks about the book, he's passionate because this is the foundation of a lot of what you saw in the Golden Age, which is what I grew up with, and then obviously the Attitude Era, which is what half of our audience grew up with.
Yeah,
but and I'm not knocking you guys. I'm just saying, like, it's that kind of party. If you're not a fan of the half hour headlock, I get it. You don't have to be.
Yeah,
but you have to respect what these guys did because the moves evolved. Our favorites through these moves. Like, come on, I mean, how great is a Kurt Angle or a Chris Benoit or Eddie Guerrero German suplex? That's Luthez.
Yeah,
Steve Austin on Anderson.
Sid Vicious's powerbomb.
Powerbomb, the German suplex, and...
STF.
STF.
Don't get a start with John Cena.
And the Luthez press, man.
Yeah.
That's on Anderson and Steve Austin. Those guys revolutionized that move. They, you know, you could say Thez started it and they perfected it. I've never seen a German suplex as badass as Chris Benoit's. And I don't like, you know, I'm not trying to praise the guy in... I'm trying to give him props to the person he was prior to his illness,
yeah,
and him killing his fucking family, you know, and then himself, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, these moves and this legacy that is Luthez is pretty much a foundation of any good wrestling story.
Yeah.
So.
And, you know, I just feel, you know, straight up, if you enjoy those kind of wrestlers, which our listeners do, you know, check out these matches. It's getting tougher and tougher to find matches from Luthez. But even WWE put up one of his matches against Argentina Rocca, and
first got to wrestle barefoot.
Yeah, which there's crazy stories about dudes wrestling barefoot,
right,
in this book,
right.
And just the bad shit that these guys receive from trying to wrestle.
Listen, there's so much stuff. We're not going to be able to cover all of it.
Yeah.
We just want to talk to Kit and get his input on what, you know, we'll ask him the question we want to ask him. But, you know, honestly, get the book. I read it. Dave read it. It's a great read. Crowbar Press comes correct all the time. They're 2-for-2 with me so far. 2-for-2 with Dave. And... you have to know that it's, again, and I keep going back to it, that's that foundation.
It's the real history lesson.
Right.
So. You know, I love talking about WWF and WCW and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, I'm really intrigued by the history of wrestling, how it, you know, became what it became. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it started off as like this. Well, wrestling's always been a work, even from the George Hackenschmidt,
the Carney stuff.
Stuff. Like it's always been a work, but you know, back then it was more about the sport, and when it became, you know, more and more of a performance, you know, there was a big clash between those guys who knew how to work, and guys who were like, oh, this is easy. Let me become a wrestler. Because I want to make money, and you know, it's just a bunch of bullshit. Because you know, just as much guys, you know, take it seriously now, guys back then, you know, took it deadly serious. You know, obviously we've heard stories about dudes like Hiro Matsuda breaking Hulk Hogan's leg, but there's some more serious and terrifying stories in this book about what these like shooters, you know, would do to guys that, you know, that they were, you know, they took it lightly, that they thought they could make like an easy buck, and didn't really have a respect for the sport, and they really fucked these guys up, and they had zero remorse,
yeah,
for what they did,
because it was a different time,
yeah,
you know, and they felt that had that sense of entitlement. So,
yeah.
All right, listen, we're going to take a quick break, plug our friends, and we'll shoot the shit a little more before Kit calls in. Dave's in studio. Good night for us tonight. It's always good when Mega Powers makes the studio runs.
Yeah.
You, of course, guys, hang out with us for a few minutes. We'll be right back. We are the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast live on The Rant, baby. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Justin Anderson, one of your hosts from the Inconclusive Breakdown Podcast, where each week we break down the news in the world of geek culture, entertainment, professional wrestling, sports, and music. We also give our spin on the typical top 10 lists and fan cast our own movies. That's the Inconclusive Breakdown Podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher, or download from inconclusivebreakdown.libsyn.com.
Hey, hey, Thelonious Punk here, and I'm interrupting an otherwise quality podcast to let you know about our little show, NXT Cast. It's the only international podcast devoted to the future of the WWE, NXT. I'm joined each week by Chris NXN Nixon and the Austrian cyborg Bernard Binder to go over the latest NXT rumours and news, as well as an in-depth analysis of the latest episodes and the current roster. So if you're looking for a wrestling podcast that covers arguably the best in-ring product that WWE is producing today, then find us on Stitcher, iTunes, Podomatic and NXTcast.net. The international podcast devoted to the yellow and black, NXT Cast.
Hey, it's your boy, the Impact player, Mr. Phil Ray, inviting you to go to ShiningWizardsNetwork.com to check out my boys, the Shining Wizards. They're four tools from Jersey. You talk about the good, the bad, the ups and downs of professional wrestling. And, of course, they always piss somebody off in the process. But they're always going to make you laugh. Check them out exclusively on the Shining Wizards Network. Go to ShiningWizardsNetwork.com. ShiningWizardsNetwork.com. Entertainment here.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. How would you describe the Scrum Cup? Well, it's a little bit like catching your parents having sex. It's awkward. It's quite funny. And yet, it's not something you want to tell everyone about. That's why we've made this here commercial for you to listen to. Every week, the Scrumcast, the finest rugby podcast in the history of, well, rugby podcast.
Every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. on Mixlr.com. Also available on iTunes and on Stitcher.
The following is a paid advertisement from Don, Tony, and Kevin Castle. The self-help seminar depicted in this program may not intend to provide any such benefit.
Has wrestling become boring for you? Find yourself ashamed to talk about it amongst your peers at work? Do you often think that maybe Nancy deserved it? Hi, I'm Anthony Black, and I'm here to tell you that you may be suffering from a serious wrestling dysfunction known as Russoitis. Russoitis is the leading cause of impotence in wrestling fans and has also been linked to abnormal levels of patience for obviously crappy gimmicks and angles. But don't worry, there is hope for you yet. Don, Tony, and Kevin Castle are here every Monday night to help you through this debilitating infliction with their deep insights and personal advice.
I could touch my entire ass.
Don, Tony, and Kevin Castle have literally helped hundreds of thousands of fans come to terms with their wrestling dysfunction, and they can help you too.
I'm on a retard.
But don't take my word for it. Listen to some testimonials from the people once afflicted by Russoitis.
Good evening, Turnbuckle Throwbacks.
Yes, hi, David Powers, please.
Yes, this is David right here. How's it
going? Hi, David, Kit? This is Kit Bauman. How are you?
Hey, pleasure to meet you, Kit.
Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm excited to do to talk about the book tonight.
That'll be fun.
Awesome.
Or I'll try to make it fun.
Oh, we talked a bit about it before we got you on. So.
Oh, you did, yeah.
Oh, this is going to be fun. Actually, we did. What was it? We did an interview with Emerson Murray, who did the Brody book.
Right.
A few months back.
So, right.
We're big Crowbar fans, and actually, this was the first book I bought from Crowbar. So.
Aha.
Yeah. Well, are we recording right now? Or?
Yeah, we are recording.
Oh, we're on. We're live.
Hey, we're on.
We're live.
Kid, how are you? Phil Ray here. What's going on?
Not a thing. How are you doing?
Good, sir. All right. So I just read the book recently myself. And, I mean, there's so much to cover, and there's so much history and lineage, and, of course, the legend that is Luthez. And Dave has a ton of stuff he wants to ask you as well. So before he gets into his spiel, I just want to – I want to know – I mean, from the first couple of chapters, I have an idea of how you got involved, but I want to hear from you, and I want to let our fans know, because we have a chat room, a bunch of people listening live, and I mean, I want to know how this came to pass. How did you get involved, and what was your input before you started writing for Luthez?
I was doing another book. I was actually doing mainly the research for it. This is like 30-something years ago, anyway. And I had one of the guys that I got to be pretty good, or had a good relationship with, was Terry Funk. And Terry Funk was working at that time in Texas, which is where I was living, was working for the San Antonio promotion and touring with them. And he came to town, Dallas, which is where I was living, and we got together, and he said, I want you to meet Luthez. So I said, sure. I knew about Lou, of course, and who he was. So we went to the matches, and he introduced me backstage to Lou, and Lou was a guest referee for one of the matches that night, and we chatted for a while, and we just hit it off pretty well. And a couple of months later, and I can't be really precise about that, but a couple of months later, I got a call from Lou asking me if I would be willing to help him write his autobiography. And what he had done in the meantime is he had spoken to Dave Meltzer with the Wrestling Observer and asked Dave if he would be interested in helping write his autobiography. And Dave, I'm eternally grateful to him for it, said that he really wasn't interested in the history of the business at that point, that he had his hands full with writing what all was going on
right.
In 1982. Certainly there was an awful lot. So I told Lou, yeah, I just put my book on the shelf and would go off to help him do his. So that's kind of like the background to how he got involved.
Yeah, and this the writing process went on for quite a bit until the early days of AOL.
Well, there was a way. I thought I knew at the time, and see, I had just turned I just turned 40, I guess, and thought that I knew pretty much about what all was entailed in writing a book. And I was in the newspaper business, and a number of my professional colleagues were writing books at that time. And there was one guy in particular, a guy with the great name Chet Flippo from Fort Worth, who's a good writer. And Chet had just come through town on a book tour, and he had written a biography of Hank Williams, the great, country and western star. And he was telling me, because I was interested, and he was telling me how he did it, what he did. He said he set up each day and listened to Hank Williams' records over and over, and read and interviewed and talked to people and wrote when he had time. And it just really sounded all very attractive to me. And I thought, well,
it sounds like something that
I could do. So I embarked at that. I mean, it's a longer story, and I'll make it very short. I just decided that I would have to write something that I could do in my spare time, because I needed to work full-time for a paycheck. So I wasn't able to just drop off the map and go write a book like Chet had done. And I knew that by that time, I thought, nobody takes professional wrestling seriously. And I knew for a variety of reasons and through a variety of relationships that it was a really interesting story. And I thought I'd like to be one of the people to try and capture that. And that's essentially what I set off to do.
Yeah, and at that time, there wasn't the mass appeal. You didn't have Hulkamania just yet.
That's true. Yep.
And Mick Foley went on, who was Cactus Jack and Mankind. His book came down the road in New York Times bestseller list, so wrestling wasn't like the hottest topic.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Yeah, it was a very hard sell, and a number of people told us it would be a hard sell. I knew one book, one way rather, one approach to trying to write a book, and that was to do the what we call the linear approach. You pick a starting point and you go out and you just follow it A to B to C and so on and so forth and on down the line. And one of the things that I thought that I knew about getting a book published at that time was that you had to have an agent. And a number of people told me that over and over and over again, that you need to have an agent. So that was the first hurdle that Lou and I had to clear. And a good friend of mine in Dallas was a successful writer in the true crime genre. And he said to me one day, he said, talk to my agent in Southern California. And the guy had a lot of success and was very well known in the publishing world as a literary agent. So we got in touch with the guy, and what was funny was that the guy said, Luthez, are you kidding? I was a Luthez fan when I was a kid. I'd love to represent him. Well, what I'd heard was always like the hardest step in getting published. We had just, in effect, the first time we tried, we got an agent. And he got out there and worked for, oh gosh, I guess, a good 6 months or more trying to sell a book proposal. And he finally just called us and said, look, nobody's interested. He said, the problem is it's professional wrestling. Nobody takes it seriously. He repeated a line that I had heard by then several times from professional wrestlers that I had met, is that it's only professional wrestling. Nobody takes it seriously. The people who watch or attend professional wrestling matches can't read anyway, so why waste your time? And so he bowed out. He asked, and very kind about it, by the way. He asked, if he could just forget about it, and he wished us well and went on his way. And at that point, Lou and I were trying to figure out, well, what do we do? We didn't even have a book proposal at that time. So we just decided that, well, it was time to start writing something and seeing if maybe somewhere along the line we can interest somebody in it. And there were other conversations with publishing houses on down the line, and probably the most interesting one and most illustrative of what we were up against was right there in Dallas. There was a publisher called Taylor Publishing, and I would not be surprised if they're still in business. I really don't know, but I had some connections there, and they got us in the door, and I went with a representative, an agent, who was willing to help us out to pitch the people at Taylor Publishing on this Luthez book. And the president of the company was there because, as it turned out, and I found this over and over and over through the years, is that he was a who was a wrestling fan. And he was really interested in this, and he knew who Lou Fez was and really wanted to hear the presentation. So we went in, and we gave him our best shot. And the president of the publishing company was enthusiastic about it and said he really wanted to do the book. But the marketing people said, we can't sell it. And they pointed out correctly and appropriately, when you take into account the business side of things, is that they had just produced a book called the Von Erich Family Album, which was just a fan book of photos and text about Fritz Von Erich and his boys, and the warehouses were just full of the book. They couldn't move it and they couldn't sell it. Nobody was interested. Therefore, the marketing people were saying these people who have an interest in pro wrestling don't buy books. So again, they said no, and so Lou and I were just kind of left with a situation about, what are we going to do? How are we going to get this book out there? And as you mentioned, a couple of minutes ago, that there still wasn't the buzz that came along when McMahon started up with the WWF and Hulk Hogan and not too long after that Mick Foley and people just weren't doing books. There were some wrestlers' autobiographies out there. Most notably, one that I came across was Bruno Sammartino, and I bought it and looked at it, and it was all, of course, kayfabe, which was fine. I understood that, but the thing that struck me about it was that he mentioned in the book, in a couple of places, he mentioned Lou Fez, and he misspelled his last name.
Oh no!
And it could have been intentional. I don't know, because there was some heat between the two of them, but still, it didn't strike me. If it was intentional, it was not a good business decision. What it told me was that no one had edited the book, and that's exactly what Lou and I ran into later on.
And the big difference was Lou completely broke kayfabe in the book.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he did.
He didn't leave any stones unturned, and I was really surprised by, especially at the time that this book was being put together. He was incredibly blunt with his opinions on all the boys at that time, especially.
It was a shock. I mean, and his wife, Charlie, in the last version of the book, which we updated, talked about that first visit when she and I first met, actually. And Lou and Charlie were living in Norfolk, Virginia at the time, and Lou and I just said, let's just get this going and see what we can do with it and give it a shot. So I said, okay, and I excuse me, I flew to Norfolk to spend a long weekend with them, and that was the point at which we made our handshake deal on writing the book. And then Lou, with what I quickly learned was his typical approach to things, and let's get to it. So we went down to the patio, and they were right on Chesapeake Bay with the water probably less than 100 feet from us, and we went down and sat in beach chairs. And I don't remember specifically what it was, but I asked him a couple of questions about this or that. And Charlie was hovering, listening, to the conversation. And I asked Lou, trying to find a point in which to really kind of get into what he was thinking about. And I asked him about Antonino Rocca. And he just took off on Rocca about just how bad Rocco was for wrestling, and
he called him a son of a bitch.
It just really was startling, and as he talked, I realized that he was apparently thinking about an altogether different sort of book than what I was thinking about. I was thinking that, you know, this would be, as you know, as we referred to it in the writing, but it would be just a quick hitter. I would go in and do my interviews and, you know, and come back and polish up all what he said. But what Lou was revealing the bones of the business, as, you know, certainly as seen and experienced by Lou Fev. And I really wasn't prepared for that. But I also knew that it was something that I really very much wanted to do and be a part of, because nobody had done it, I guess, is a way of putting it. And Lou certainly realized what he was doing. And so it was flattering to me that we were able to establish that personal bond as early and as quickly as we could, and enable him to be comfortable with me in terms of trying to tell his story. We just didn't know that it was going to take us, you know, 10 years to produce a book. Is the thing that really sticks in my mind.
Yeah, because I was really curious how a guy like that, you know, he's been involved in the business since, you know, the 30s. He was a relatively young champion at 21. And, and gone through the real, you know, age of kayfabe. And I was curious, like, how, you know, trusting he was of you, you know, to write his story. Because, well, from what you're telling me, it just seems like he was ready to go for this.
I had the advantage at that point of having, I guess I'd been plugging away at my Texas book for about a year. And, you know, originally the focus of it was, you know, much more narrow. It was just going to be on the Amarillo, the history of the Amarillo promotion and what life was like with those wrestlers. So at the outset, and through a variety of devices and relationships, I'd met people and spent time with guys like Fritz von Erich, and who introduced me to Terry Funk, who introduced me to, I mean, from there you can just go on and on. But I was being very, what do you call it, careful or respectful in my approach to these people, because in 1981, 82, you weren't going to go to these, you know, professional wrestlers and say, it's all fake, isn't it? You know, the kayfabe was still respected and still practiced in those days. And it was very interesting. And I had been told that, you know, what to expect, so that a number of people who were outside of the professional wrestling business, who were aware of my interest and also had an interest on their own, said to me, you know, you need to take your time, be very patient with these guys, and be careful about how you approach them, because the one thing that they will not respond to is a lack of respect for the business or a lack of respect for what they do. And when you get involved in that, one thing led to another, and I really don't remember the details of how it happened, but I was told about this guy who was living in Wichita Falls, Texas at that time, whose name was Dave Meltzer, and he was doing this newsletter, which was just wonderful because it had all kinds of insights into what was really going on behind the scenes. And so I was put in touch with him, and I got to know Dave and visited with him a few times. And it's kind of the network. That's what happened. Lou was getting, was getting copies, free copies of newsletters from, it seemed like everybody was putting out a newsletter in those days. And he would be getting them in the mail, and one of them was of course Meltzer's, and Lou was in touch was cordial with him, and Lou, you know, would talk with Meltzer from time to time, and as I said, Lou had approached him about doing the book, and Dave said, no, the guy you really want to deal with is Kit Bauman, and because he's a little more interested than I am in the earlier days, and I was. So he was comfortable with me by then, and he knew a little bit about me from people that he was comfortable with and trusted. So it was really sort of effortless. Kind of looking back on it, was really a surprise. But we plunged right into it. It was it's kind of like going off the high board, you know, into the deep end of the pool. And I wasn't really all that well prepared for it. I had been plugging away on my book for a while and thought I understood a lot of the intricacies and the history of the business, but I truly didn't. And I also, as I had said when Terry Funk told me he wanted to introduce me to Lou, I was enthusiastic about it just because I knew that Lou had a long role in the history of wrestling in Texas, which was what my primary focus was at the time. And it sounds a little cold. I don't mean it this way, but I wanted to use Lou to improve the quality of whatever I was going to end up writing about Texas wrestling. And he was certainly willing to do that, and he did, as a matter of fact. But it was more of a short-term selfish interest on my part than it developed into once we got into trying to tell Lou's story.
So, I mean, without getting into, you know, in-depth detail, what was the high spots for you in terms of when you were actually going through the writing process? What was some of the better things that Lou was really open to you about that you think he wouldn't open up to anybody else? Like, you know, like, was it his promoting? Was it the actual matches he had?
The business side of it is really the fascinating side. He learned so early that you do not trust the promoter. You learn how to deal, how to make deals for yourself. You learn how to take care of yourself in those kind of situations. And I'm talking about as a businessman and not necessarily as an athlete. I mean, he had that pretty well covered anyway at a fairly early age. But it was the insights that he provided and volunteered and wanted to talk about how the business really operated. And I don't think anybody had done that before. I had read by the time that we had started on the book, I had read the books like Fall Guys and, I can't think of the name of it right now, but From Milo to Londos, books that were supposed to be behind the scenes books about the, you know, the really early days of the business in the U.S.
But they were still just kayfabe.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. At least in terms of the depth of the detail, they made it clear that it was a worked business. But in terms of how it actually worked and what you could expect, those were the fun things. That was the fun thing to find. And then, excuse me, from there you went to when he would start telling stories, and he loved to tell these stories. When he would start telling his stories about his matches with Buddy Rogers.
See, he absolutely hated Rogers.
just incredible stuff. Really interesting. I have to tell you, and this is not disloyal at all, but I really do believe that Rogers was probably the most important wrestler figure of that era.
Well, yeah, and, yeah. I mean, entertaining wise,
absolutely.
Yeah, because there was no. I mean, there wasn't a lot of showmanship.
No,
it was straight up shoot and grappling, and you know the transition from amateur to professional was so easy and it was almost natural. Where
right.
Buddy Rogers did the same thing, except he was a showman.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
you know, I think that transcended, you know, the what is now sports entertainment.
I agree.
So
yeah, I think he built it. Lou was the one who pretty much smartened me up to that fact, or at least made me look at it that way, because Lou had said that Lou could go out there and do what he could do with the amateur moves and all that kind of stuff, but in terms of the showmanship and the electricity, no, he didn't bring that to the ring, and he needed a guy like Rogers. And he understood that he needed a guy like Rogers, and the fact that they didn't get along all that well personally was, was one thing, but it was beside the point. That the point was to make money, and that it's always what Lou said to me over and over and over again. That was really the point of the game, was to make money. So.
Yeah. Because even with the advent of Rogers and Gorgeous George, it seemed like
It
seemed like a big change. Because
absolutely.
And we were talking before you came on. He had a grounding relationship with Strangler Lewis, Ed Strangler Lewis, and that guy would have 4-hour matches.
Mm-hmm.
And you're from what was that, like the 20s. Early 1900s,
right.
And then not too long after that, you have the advent of television, and guys like Gorgeous George and Buddy Rogers are coming on the scene, and they're making big money, and it's guys like Fez who, also as we discussed before you came on, like whoever the champion was somebody who had to kind of be able to hold his own ground, and these guys couldn't.
That's true.
And but he had to work with these guys if he wanted to, still remain relevant.
That's absolutely right.
And make a living for himself.
That's absolutely right, yeah. And the guys that he worked with, for the most part, knew it too. I was looking at a thread on one of these websites the other day. It was guys who the thread was guys who didn't like Lou Thesz. Well, there were lots of guys out there who didn't like Lou Thesz, and I met many of them and talked to many of them in the course of writing the book, because it became apparent to me that I didn't want to look like a total fool, and I had said a few times on email exchanges that I'm really not an apologist for Lou. I mean, I love Lou. I really did. He was a great guy. And I was so blessed to have had his friendship. But I wasn't an apologist for him. And so I happily talked to guys that I knew that had issues with Lou Thesz. And they all came back to the same thing, was that he was the real deal in the ring, that you just didn't mess with him, and his instincts for the most part were pretty good, and you didn't cross him or go against whatever it was he was trying to do. So you just sort of like went along with with whatever the program happened to be,
yeah,
night to night. But the thing that Lou said about himself, and as well as these other guys, is that everybody wants to be on top. Everybody wants to make the top dollar, but somebody's got to carry you there. And Lou was the guy for a good 8 or 10 year period, was the guy who carried a lot of people to that point. And that was essentially the role that he had prepared himself for, and that he was really able to carry out. He was very fortunate when you think about it, because he was not a young man, but he was in his late late 20s and heading into his 30s when television came along. And by then he had enough years under his belt to have a pretty good idea about what he was doing in the ring. Mm. And he also had, because of the people that he had emulated and became friends with over the years on the way up, like Ed Lewis and oh gosh, I'm blocking on his name, how awful, Ray Steele, he had learned the intricacies of the business pretty well. When television came along, Lou was really pretty much perfectly positioned. You know, we talk about Rogers and the showmanship that and the athleticism that he brought to the ring. But as Lou said to me several times, that it wouldn't have worked that well without Rogers having someone like Lou Fez to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's like really interesting, especially now, because it was at a, you know, I had a brief friendship with the Ultimate Warrior, who passed away not too long ago.
Yep.
And
yep.
He, for his WWE Hall of Fame speech, he just blatantly said, you know, there's a lot of guys that, you know, when they're on TV, they act like they're tough, but in real life, regardless of how they look, they can't really, you know, back up the image that they portray.
Yeah, that's true.
On television. Yeah. And, you know, Fez is pretty much, you know, part of that dying breed of, you know, guys who could legit go. And,
yeah, I don't know who's left. I mean, I really don't. Part of my problem is that I pretty much quit watching the wrestling product out there. Oh, gosh. Well, a good 10 years ago for sure. And just really don't pay attention to it, so I don't really know if there's anybody left. I would think that Billy Robinson might have been one of the last of those kind of guys, but he certainly didn't have the kind of success or fame that somebody like Lou had.
Well, Lou's legacy, because I'm going to be almost 40 in a couple of months, and going through the golden age, which for me, anyways, from anywhere from 1983 to about 1999, 2000, uh-huh. For me, you know, Lou Fez was always an intricate part of big events, like Legends reunions, and they would have him as a referee in certain matches. And, I mean, for goodness sakes, he wrestled at 71 years old.
Right.
And
yeah.
Openly admitted that he shouldn't have, but he did. And it wasn't like a thing where it was unwatchable. It was right, straight up old school throwback strong style in Japan in one of their main cards, and it just
one of their top guys
against their top guy at the time.
Yeah,
and it was just astounding to see that as you know as a 16-year-old, I was beside myself reading that in a magazine. So, you know. What was Lou's fondest moments, as a wrestler, first and foremost, to you anyway, and after he was in the business? Like, you know, like what was his fondest memories of being involved in the business after he stopped wrestling?
He loved Ed Lewis, and he loved traveling with Ed Lewis. And as a matter of fact, as an aside, it's one of the things I think that probably endured and endeared Lou to me when I told him that I had met Ed Lewis when I was 10 years old, I guess.
Wow.
About then. And he was the guest speaker at a Boy Scouts troop meeting I went to. There were like maybe 15 kids in the room that night is all.
And there's a bunch of stories in the book that are not kid-friendly.
Oh, that's true. That's absolutely right.
Ed Lewis sex party
story. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But we came, you know, we came to the Boy Scout meeting, and there's this is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it's like 1951 or 52, and there's this massive man sitting in the front row as we're all, you know, coming in for the meeting, and we're told it's our guest speaker for the night. It's Ed Strangler Lewis, and I knew who he was because the news and the newspapers in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in those days, you know, pointed out with pride that the Strangler lived there and at that time. And in fact, I've still got his autograph. I had him autograph my Boy Scout handbook, which I had with me that night. But it's interesting. It's funny the things that stick in your mind, and I don't believe in anything sort of mystical about it. It just really has struck me and stayed with me for a long time that this was really the first celebrity that I ever met, you know, was Ed Lewis. And I could see from the aura of, I guess I would say, of the guy, you know, what it was about him that struck Lou Thesz, because Lou just dearly loved his time with Ed Lewis. And when he would talk about the things that he enjoyed most about his career and that made it, he wouldn't talking about wrestling or what he accomplished in the ring or those sort of thing. He would talk about things like dining out with Ed Lewis, or having Ed Lewis over to his mother's house in St. Louis, and just taking such great pleasure and the enjoyment that Ed Lewis would express in the food that they were having, and that kind of stuff. Those are the things that really sort of stick in my mind. On more or less on the back on the actual wrestling aspects of it, Lou, the last couple of years of his life was living in the Orlando, Florida area. Excuse me. And I was living nearby. It was just coincidental. But that was great because I would go over and see Lou from time to time. And one day he called me and he said, come on over. I need a driver. He said, I'm going to start teaching some of these kids around here how to hook. And, I said, all right, I've got to see what this is all about. So I drove over to his home. It was in Winter Garden, which is a suburb there of Orlando, and figured out where we're going to go. We were supposed to be going to a gym that Lou had been told about, and a guy he had met, rather, I'm sorry, that and Lou had said that he would like to have a space where he can teach some basics of wrestling and hooking, and he would prefer to have some students who were knowledgeable about in amateur wrestling. So we said, okay, fine, we did that. And so we drove to the gym, and he had like maybe two or three kids who looked to be high school age and who said that they were members of their high school wrestling team, and they wanted to learn how to use hooks. So what Lou did is he would take them two by two, take them down on the mat, and have the one kid apply a hold to his opponent, and then he would show the kid who was in control. He would say, do this, move your hand here, or move your other hand there, move your leg there, pull or push. I mean, subtle stuff, and I can't really even do it justice, but the guy on the mat would just be screaming in pain, and Lou would look up at me and he would grin and wink, this sort of stuff. I mean, he wasn't enjoying hurting somebody, he was just enjoying passing on something so simple as the lessons of leverage or whatever. And it's an art. It was an art form, and it was a. He was proud that he was one of the few people around who still knew how to do it. It was not to last. He didn't really market it, or word didn't get around, or people weren't interested. There's always that realistic possibility, but that's one of the. That's also one of the memories that I take away from that period of time with him. You just had great pride in what it was he could do.
No, well, I actually, this is the first time for us, because we normally, this is like our second and third interview, and everything, you know, just like everything just went out kaput on us, so I apologize for that.
Yeah. No, not a problem. Don't apologize for that.
Yeah, the feed
control it.
Yeah, the feed went completely dead. Even people in the chat room were like, what happened?
Really?
Yeah. So, but what I was trying to tell you, because I couldn't even hear my voice on the end, we were talking about how it's a lost art form, like hooking. Like I don't even really know anybody who does it anymore.
I don't either. No, I absolutely don't. I suspect that, I can't even tell you where I came across it, but there was a guy in Norfolk that Lou took under his wing, Mark Fleming. Who I'm sure that Mark probably knows a bit about it, but I never got to know Mark really well. I met him. I was around him a couple of times when I was up there doing interviews with Lou for the book. But gosh, I really don't know. Lou would have taught Mark how to, you know, about hooks and stuff like that. And I do know from all the years that I've more or less been around the fringes of this business that it seems like most guys in the business, wrestlers who have any kind of ability at all, learn a hook or two. But in terms of being able to call themselves hookers and have that full encyclopedia of knowledge, I don't think there's anyone left these days, and I honestly don't know, but I would be surprised if there's anyone out there, mainly because there's not anyone to pass it along to them.
Yeah, and I know guys like Billy Robinson passed away not too long ago, sort of Carl Gotch, and there's
yep.
guys that, you know, have touted that they've, you know, had that knowledge passed on to them, but, you know, a lot of people, you know, fire back, and it's like, oh, well, this guy had one or two training sessions with Gotch, and, you know, that's all that they got.
Yep. But, yeah. yeah. And from what I'm told, it took a little more time than just a session or two, you know, to pick up on it. So.
Absolutely. Now, you know, we mentioned Lou had the match in New Japan against Masahiro Chono.
Right.
How in shape was this guy, you know, when you knew him? Like, do you think you feel he could still throw down, or, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, absolutely could. But the thing about it, and it sounds like y'all really prepared well for this, so you know that Lou said, you know, it was a big mistake on his part to accept that match. But you know, you love the spotlight, and you'd like to get out there one more time and feel. He was definitely in shape, but he had a hip replacement. And I forget the timing on it, but it had been like a year, maybe a little more than that, before the match, and he really thought that he would be able to get out there and perform. He was going to do the job for Chono, but he thought he'd be able to get out there and perform, and his hip gave out on him when he tried to do a souple, I think it was. I forget, but.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's when he called it and said, no, let's go home, you know, get out of here, because he knew then he couldn't handle it. But otherwise, I mean, I will tell you that for, what was he, 71, 72 years old at the time, you know, the guy was in really good shape.
Yeah.
I had seen him, he's got a great story that he tells. Well, actually, it's not a story that he tells, it's a story that, Ole Anderson tells in his book about going down to the Orlando area, their Winter Park, to visit Lou, and the apartment complex where Lou and Charlie lived had a weight room, an exercise room, and carpeted. And every time I went to see Lou, we would go over to the exercise room and work out. And it was mainly all flexibility stuff and light weights to, you know, just kind of keep muscle tone. Well, Ole Anderson went down to visit with Lou, and he said to Lou, you know, you want to get on the mat here a little bit? Lou said, yeah, sure, you know. Took him down and stretched him and just left Ole in real pain because Ole had been out of the business for a little while too. Well, the reason for mentioning that is that one time I was over there visiting with Lou and we had gone down to work out, and I just, as a joke, said to Lou, you think you can take me? And his face just lit up, you know. Just the idea of getting down on the floor with somebody was just too attractive to him, you know. And he just laughed. He said, I would hurt you so quickly, so easily, without even trying to, that we better not do it.
Yeah, because there's some stories in there of, like, we're not going to get too in-depth because we want people to buy the book. But,
sure.
But just the ease that some of these hookers were able to just ruin a guy's life.
Yep.
Like, there's one guy who he was a performer and was one of Lou's trainers, George Tragos, just didn't take a liking to him and didn't want to lose to him. Ended the guy's career right then and there.
Yeah, that's an awful story. I have still off and on try to research off the internet, see if I can find any documentation on it. I mean, I really believe that it happened, but I'm familiar with the story that you're talking about. He just, you know, hurt a kid who didn't apparently respect Tragus or respect the business, and I guess that's how they taught those people in those days. Yeah, terrible thing. Yeah.
Now, just some stuff that's not mentioned in the book.
Sure.
Me and Phil were kind of talking about this because we were going to briefly have on the author of The Big Gold Belt, Dick Bourne, who did this full book all about the NWA title, specifically the one that Flair had that went into NWA, WCW. But I was kind of curious because we got like a lot of like belt fans, and we even had Dave Milliken, who does the WWE titles, on the
right.
Show. What happened with like Lou Thesz's NWA championship, or even
Lou's belt, it's reflective, I guess, of how little I really knew or appreciated when I first began working with Lou on the book. Very first trip that I made to Norfolk to sit down and do interviews with him, he took me in the house and showed me this place of honor. There was the belt that he'd had, and it had it made, and I can't be held to it. I can't off the top of my head remember. But 1937 or 38, he had it, had the belt maker there and a jeweler in St. Louis make the belt, and he kept it for all those years. He sold the belt to he sold the belt to his friend Koji Miyamoto in Japan, which got to be 10-15 years ago, I think.
Well, he died in 2002, so it was before that, right?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, I think it would have been just before then. You'll have to forgive me. I'm not really clear on the date.
That's fine.
That's when you're done.
Yeah, again, there's so much information to absorb. You know, it's almost overwhelming. But the book is so well done that, you know.
Dave, oh, thanks.
But Dave and I were like, this, for us anyway, as we're an old school wrestling podcast. What we do is just talk about old wrestling.
Right.
And the further back we go, and Dave and I spoke about this briefly before you called in, is, you know, laying the foundation for a lot of our younger fans who really could, I mean, they're not, again, like, going back to the whole showmanship, they're not going to really appreciate the half-hour headlock, as they call it.
But, right.
You know, but
Johnny Valentine, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, the best part about this is you're actually the second guy we spoke to who's actually a fan of the business. You weren't just writing a book for the sake of writing the book because of the person, you know, you weren't writing because of just the person. You actually.
Oh, that's absolutely right, yeah.
You know, so it's more of a, we're getting a history lesson as well as what you've done with Luthez and the book, so.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. That's really what Lou and I, as in the early stages, as we were just. I go back to that to the thing I mentioned 30 minutes ago about when he was carrying on about his feelings about Antonino Rocca and stuff, and surprised me with what really he wanted to say and why he wanted to say it, and at some point we discussed the fact that we weren't just doing a story about Lou. We were essentially doing a story about the history of the business, which deserves to be treated with some respect, because it was, you know, it was an enormous entertainment outlet, for lack of a better term. And it's like Dave Meltzer once, back in the early days when he and I were both young and dealing with this, and Meltzer made the comment. He said, "I can't think of anything that is more popular that gets so little serious news coverage." And that's exactly the way I looked at it. I couldn't believe that there was this entertainment empire out there that was treated with just such disdain, because I've known people everywhere I've gone, and for one reason or another it comes up, but I've known people everywhere I go who, like, oh yeah, pro wrestling, at some point in their lives they cross paths with it.
Absolutely. And going along with what you said, it's still strange, you know, wrestling still has that stigma to it, but at the same time, you know, there's cities that are, you know, going into bidding wars to have WrestleMania in their town.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And you know, they're gaining like 70 to 80,000 people, you know, coming to WrestleMania for the show.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's tourism. It's business. Business, as I like to say back in Texas. Really, I saw it change I was fortunate enough for a variety of reasons in there in 82, 83, back in the Dallas area, and when I decided to go write my book. And I wasn't really thinking about it at the time, but I did notice there in the Dallas area that the world-class championship wrestling show started up on Channel 39 there in Dallas, and it was the handheld cameras and just the production values were so different. The Free Birds came to town to went through a turn to become the opponents of the Von Erichs and stuff, and I got to see all of that up close from an informed point of view, which was really unusual, I would submit. And it was exciting. There's just no other way to describe it at the time. And to have gone through all of that and to look back on it now is just like, I mean, it's really fond memories for me. And I understand it from the point of view of a fan. And I guess that's really one of the messages that, that stuck with me the longest, was that the first person that I reached out to when I decided I was going to try and write a book about professional wrestling. And I remind you that at the time it wasn't about Lou Thesz, it was going to be about Texas. And I thought, well, I better try Fritz Von Erich and see what he said. And he had me out to his house. And he said, what's your approach to all of this? And more to the point, he said, are you going to respect the fans? Because I can't help you out if you don't have respect for the fans. And I said, well, of course I respect the fans, because I've been a fan and am a fan, I guess. And that probably as much as any single thing, you know, said to me, relax, you know, kick back. Don't take all of this too seriously. There's cheap laughs and cheap digs to be made in there, but just ignore that and take a little closer look at what the business really is, because it's entertained thousands upon thousands of people.
Absolutely.
For many years now.
Still to this day.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So WrestleMania is absolutely no surprise.
Yeah, and even Monday Night Raw, as bad as it is nowadays, like it's still, they get more viewers than like basketball and like all these other sports.
Yeah, they pull.
Oh yeah,
yeah, they pull better numbers than most of the sports that are out there.
Yeah, I look back at the notes that not all that long ago. I look back at some of the notes from Hooker and a lot of things in the book that, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, weren't researched all that well and had a lot to do with the sort of tools that we had available to us at the time. But one thing that was accessible to us were TV ratings, and wrestling was always hot. Wrestling has always been hot. There has been slumps, which, of course, is not all that unusual or with associated with anything that's broadcast, but it always did, in the aggregate, did better than hockey, did better than NBA basketball, did better than baseball. It's a situational kind of thing. And you look at some of the ratings for certain programs in certain areas for a sustained period of time, and it was always has been an amazing business. Mm. So, and I, you know, it's nice. That is one of the things I feel good about, is it does seem like the world has at least begun to show a little more respect or appreciation for the business. I do. I give Mick Foley a lot of credit for it. He had the name value and he had the platform, and more than anything, he had the publishing platform behind him to get his book on the New York Times bestseller list.
It was perfect timing too.
Oh yeah, absolutely right. And I told Lou, I said, well, you're partly responsible for that. You know, at least you made it viable for people. I can't tell you the number of people that have told me, or for that matter had told Lou after his book came out, that it made it possible for them to write their books. Jack Briscoe was one. Gary Hart definitely was one. Guys who never would have broken kayfabe if Lou hadn't come out and done his own book.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on, because this book set the tone for, like you mentioned, a lot of other wrestlers.
I like to believe that. I mean, I really do. I thank you. I do believe that. Mm. But it's certainly not what we set out to do. It was just sort of like Well, it was very much in keeping with Lou's character. He just really wasn't going to put on a pose for the sake of, you know, hoping to sell a book. And I don't know about Lou, but, you know, I was certainly very proud of what we were able to do, as long as it took us to do it. But it was great.
Yeah, and for me, this is presently my favorite pro wrestling book, just for the rich history that's in here, just the no holds barred that he just approaches everything, you know, from all the promoters. And there's you know, guys like Vince Sr. that's mentioned in there. You know, Frank Tunney, Jack Tunney's father.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so mind-blowing, and you know, just how things were back then, and you know, things have changed dramatically, but also at the same time, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of things haven't changed all that much.
Well, that's true.
From the mentality. Yeah. But
that is the amazing thing about it, isn't it, now that you think about it?
Yeah. Well, we got one more question for you before we let you go, before we wrap up. And this is just like, kind of like a joke question, but I've always been boggled by this. Where did Lou get those referee shirts? To me, it looked like a Duran Duran cover just vomited off her shirt.
They're awful. I mean, you know, I hope Charlie's not listening to this. She made them.
Oh, no. Oh,
yeah,
no.
I don't know if it was her own design or his, but that's where he got it. She sewed a lot of his clothes. He was, like a lot of those guys, had a hard time buying clothes off the rack in the stores. So when he discovered that Charlie could sew, I mean, that was such a bonus for him.
Yes.
And he asked her to start making these clothes for him.
Yes.
And that's where they came from.
Because for me, like, it's very hard to find Luthez matches, but it's easy to find the ones where he refereed, and those those shirts always stood out. Like,
right.
for those that are listening who haven't seen these referee shirts, they look like this, like, early 80s UK ska revival, Duran Duran, like, kind of album cover.
Well put. Oh, they're awful. Yeah, yeah, they really are. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah,
I enjoyed this.
Well, the book is Hooker. We're talking to Kit Bauman. You can get it on crowballpress.com. Kit, are you doing anything else right now? Are you involved with social media? You do Facebook? You do Twitter, all of that?
No, I retired about 5 years ago, and feeling like I had earned it, and no, I'm really not doing anything.
All right. Well, again, I mean, arguably the greatest wrestler, like it says, of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
And his gimmick was wrestling, the straight shooter, the hooker, as they say, Luthez. And Kit, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate the invitation.
And we're huge World Class fans and Von Erich and Freebird fans. Maybe we'll have you back on, and we'll shoot about that, because we really dig that era as well. So,
oh, that'd be fun. Yeah, I'd enjoy that too.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. We'll definitely have you back. And guys, go to crowballpress.com, pick up the book. It's a fantastic read, and Kit Bowman did a really good job on it. So kudos to you, sir.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Kit.
Have a good night, Kit.
Great. Good night.
Well. Okay.
The one and only Kit Bauman, everybody.
Yeah, you know what? I apologize for the audio. I didn't know. I mean,
yeah, I didn't. I just, while we were talking, it just kind of like.
I mean, you were still recording, so I'll edit that for the download, so you don't hear, you know, Dave yelling for me downstairs.
Yeah.
Giving my wife her dinner, but.
Because while once he was done talking and I started talking, like, the sound from my headphones went, and then his call went out, so then I had to run down to get you.
Yeah, I kind of expected this to happen with him not going on a tangent, but there's so much information to absorb. And, I mean, Dave told me that before he gave me the book.
This is a real, like, visceral kind of look at the business at that time.
Right.
And the guy really just doesn't hold back his opinion on folks. And like we mentioned, Argentina Araca, you know, that was a big name also for, you know, WWF in their early days. And, you know, it just people that he felt, you know,
didn't put a good shine on the business. He just tore them apart. And it's an incredible read. You get to hear some wild stories, especially about like hookers that are just like, you know, really crippling guys in the ring because they had no respect for the business. And you know, how this guy was able to you know, transition his career from, you know, being this like straight shooter to, you know, the entertainment part of the business with television coming into the picture. And you know, him even wrestling Chono in 1990 at the age of 71, which is insane.
I'm just glad that the book set the tone for, like we mentioned, guys like Mick Foley and Jericho and Austin. And I think Ric Flair's book is amazing.
Yeah.
Because they're, I mean, you have to understand something. And I keep going back to that foundation thing I keep saying about a lot of these guys that we grew up idolizing, they idolized Luthez and Billy Robinson and, you know,
Carl Gotch
and those cats, because they set the tone for, you know, what we have now. And more importantly, and Kid even mentioned it, Buddy Rogers, quote-unquote, the original Nature Boy. But, you know, I guess imitation is the best form of flattery. And when certain people pull it off, they get away with it, and they make a legacy out of it. And that's what guys like Ric Flair did, and guys like Dusty Rhodes and The Rock, and, you know,
yeah,
Hulk Hogan.
It's just the same old stuff, you know, even from back then.
Yeah.
Things and haven't changed that much.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, listen, you know, we can't tell you enough. Get the book. Get the book. Get all their books.
They're, yeah.
I mean, Crowbar Press comes correct. We're thankful for them. And, you know, we'll probably have him back on because I really want to, because he got into that Texas stuff and I was like,
he's friends with Terry Funk.
Yeah, realize that. He's friends with Terry Funk.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's cool.
And especially that point in time, it's like when I was working with Beyond not too long ago, like I felt uncomfortable being with those guys. And these are guys of today that haven't even made it. I can only imagine how it was back then with those kind of guys. And I found it really intriguing that, you know, he said during the interview that, you know, him getting trust from these guys was effortless. It just happened.
Right.
Which is bizarre, you know, especially from that era.
Well, they had their platform. I mean, social media wasn't a thing yet, you know. Social media wasn't a thing yet. These guys didn't have Facebook and Twitter and MySpace and shit like that. They had, I mean, they had the internet, the beginning of it,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't have anybody who wanted to take the time to record all this information, because these guys went from territory to territory.
Yeah,
it went from San Antonio to St. Louis. I mean, you know, he was the king of St. Louis at one point.
Yeah,
before Harley Race.
And at the time, St. Louis was the spot for wrestling.
The spot. And I know Pastor Sadell is a St. Louis guy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he knows the lineage that is that area, the gateway to the West, if you will.
Yeah.
You know? So, and, you know, Sugar Shane's right. It's kayfabe at its finest. You know, you didn't get that feel like that's the first thing he said when he called in. He's like, yeah, you know, kayfabe was still in effect.
Yeah.
And I say that all the time when we do our throwback, because it's the mystique of not knowing. I mean, we're just overloaded with information now, and we're overloaded with a lot of shitty stuff on TV.
Yeah.
You know, on all levels, on WWE, TNA, every promotion has a shitty, you know, piece to it. So,
yeah,
it is what it is. So we thank him, and hopefully we'll get some more guys on and some more books. And
yeah, we'll definitely be doing more Crowbar guys, because that's our hookup.
That's our hook,
and,
yo.
We'll definitely. Next one, I definitely want to do a wrestler and get him on, get somebody on. I have somebody in mind, but we'll.
Yeah, we'll keep that on the wraps until.
Yeah, yeah, nothing.
And I apologize, I had to cut the promos that I normally play because he was calling in. He was supposed to call in at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
He called a little before that, and as you can hear, he took up some time, so I'm glad I actually cut. So I apologize, Don Tony and Kevin Castle, for, you know, not playing a full plug. And I thank Don Tony for plugging us on his show this week.
Thank you, Don Tony.
Yeah, it's a good deal. I think we should start wrapping shit up.
Yeah.
You know, it's getting kind of late.
It's getting late.
Getting late. So let me start playing some music. And so, all right. Listen.
Smooth.
Yeah, I want to thank Kid Bowman for calling in.
Yeah.
Good job, Mega Powers, on that. Holding it down.
Again, this is, like, my favorite wrestling book. And, you know, despite the times, like, there's some crazy-ass stories in this book.
Yeah, there
especially
are.
Especially that Ed Lewis sex story.
Yeah, you got to get the book. I can't say it enough. I really can't. All right, so let's start wrapping this up. We are the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast on the rant, emradio.com. We are a Shining Wizards Network production. ShiningWizardsNetwork.com is the place. You can get us on Facebook, facebook.com/turnbuckle throwbacks. We're on a tweet machine at tbuckletbacks. You want to snail mail us, turnbuckle throwbacks@gmail.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, Buzzsprout, Audio Boo, and Geek Life Radio every Saturday evening, I believe it is, 9 o'clock East, Central Standard Time, yeah. I believe. Shout out to the Shining Wizards, the Midnight Jury, Neckbreaker, Two and a Half Wrestlers, Apex Wrestling Entertainment, The Wolfman, Jack Foley, Just Incredibles, Pro Wrestling 101. You got The Rant, obviously, The Wrestling Call-In Show, What Are You Reading, the Lex Experience, Don, Tony, Kevin Castle, thanks again, Wrestling Soup, The Bloke Show, Mega Powers Radio, NXT Cast, Metal Thunder Radio, Tattoos and Touchdowns, Will Sweeney and Chris Espo. I keep forgetting, like, it's Justin has the Inconclusive Breakdown podcast. Good show last week by those guys, by the way.
I still got to check it out, but I still got to just make time for anything nowadays.
Yeah, I do it to the phone. And, of course, Uncle Eddie and the Ham Radio Show.
That's a lot of podcasts to listen to.
Well, I try. I have a shitty commute, so, I mean, it happens. Go. Next week, former WWF photographer.
Tom Buchanan,
that's going to be a trip.
Yo, I really love Tom. I haven't, like, met the guy or anything like that, but, like, since I've added him on Facebook a while back, the dude, like, if somebody posts something about wrestling, specifically WWF, he'll randomly come out of nowhere with, like, a full-length story of some, like, great stuff. So be ready for some tall tales and yarns or whatever next week.
Hey, we have t-shirts, too. ProWrestlingTees.com/TurnbuckleThrowbacks. All right, so for the Mega Powers, I'm the Impact Player, Mr. Phil Ray, bidding you adieu. Guys, take care of yourselves and each other. Avoid the clap. Don't get arrested. And we'll see you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.
And we'll see you on Baker Street.
Peace and chicken grease. The door, he's got that look on his face, and he asks you where you've been. You tell him you've seen. Got this dream about buying some land. He's gonna give up the booze and the one night stands, and then he'll settle down in some quiet little town and forget about everything. But you know he'll always keep moving. You know he's never gonna stop moving, 'cause he's rolling, he's the roll. It's a new morning. The sun is shining. It's a new.